ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And I think this statehood comment was a further leap forward. The question is whether it's a leap too far.
My government is concerned with the fight against inflation. Peter Dutton's concerned about fighting culture wars.
And I think if the Prime Minister wants to renege on an election commitment he's taken to the last two elections, I think he should call an election.
The housing system is cooked in this country.
And I was praying that the Minister and the government would finally wake up to themselves and do the right thing.
Welcome to the Party Room. I'm Fran Kelly, host of Saturday Extra, joining you from Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney.
And I'm Melissa Clark, ABC National Affairs Editor, joining you from Ngunnawal country and land of many Indigenous families. I'm here at Parliament House in Canberra, and I'm joining you because Patricia Karvelas is taking a very well-earned break.
She certainly has earned it. And Mel, it's so great to have you on board. PK will be back next week, but we're lucky to have you at all, Mel, by the sound of things. You're battling on through a nasty cold. Now, everyone, Mel assures me she's feeling okay. She just sounds a bit coldy. But Mel, thanks for being here.
Look, I've always wanted a husky jazz voice, I've got to say. But look, I'm feeling great.
Well, more than that, it's a great week to have you here because, Mel, you've got, you know, a real interest in foreign policy, and it's been a huge week for foreign and defence announcements and shifts here in Australia this week. We're going to be joined later in the podcast by Guardian Australia political editor Karen Middleton, also a foreign policy watcher. The announcements include the appointment of the new Chief of the Defence Forces, the deployment of a former Chief of Defence Force to Israel to examine Israel's investigation of the fatal airstrike that killed those seven aid workers, including Australian aid worker Zomi Francom in Gaza last week. And then we got a major speech from our Foreign Minister Penny Wong, in which she came very, very close to suggesting Australia would support Palestinian statehood.
Peace, security for Israel will only be achieved if we have a Palestinian state alongside the Israeli state. I don't see, any security for Israel without the issue of Palestinian statehood being resolved.
Palestinian statehood. Mel, she didn't say it, but plenty of critics thought they heard it, a shift from our government to support Palestinian statehood, and the opposition didn't hold back.
A decision like this by Australia, watched from that region, will be seen, I believe, only as emboldening the terrorists.
So the opposition went for broke. What was this pretty powerful speech from Penny Wong all about, Mel, if it wasn't a declaration by the Albanese government of support for Palestinian statehood? Because just to put everyone in the frame, Australia already has bipartisan support for a two-state solution, and we have had for many decades, but not yet for Palestinian statehood in advance of that. Is that changing?
That's right. Well, the government is not necessarily saying it will change, but it's willing to consider a change in approach. This is a really nuanced difference, but I think it's significant because these positions are so carefully calibrated by not just, you know, the Australian government and the opposition and who sits in those roles at the time, but different countries around the world. The thing that has caught attention is that she is saying that international recognition of a Palestinian state could help bring about a two-state solution. That's the key to what she has said this week that has brought attention, because by saying it could help bring about a two-state solution, it suggests that official recognition of a Palestinian state could come before a final negotiated settlement.
Yeah, part of a pathway.
Exactly. So it's sort of flipping the order of how the Australian government has previously said it would like to see things. Currently, it wants a negotiated settlement, and that would lead to recognition of a Palestinian state. Now she's flagging that she is considering the idea of we could look at recognition earlier in that process as a way to get to a negotiated settlement. And I think it's really following the lead of the UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron, because he was making this kind of suggestion last week as well, saying that statehood can't be a starting point, but it can't be the end point, or it doesn't necessarily have to be the end point either. It might be better if that horizon towards a better future, is how we phrased it, is something that can be on the table.
Yeah, and it's important to note here that Penny Wong did have conditions on this. I mean, she did say Hamas must have no part in any kind of Palestinian state, and she did reiterate the immediate need to see hostages released and a ceasefire in Gaza. So it wasn't that she was just saying because this is the criticism coming from the opposition front benches, a long line of them saying, you know, this would just be rewarding terrorists for a brutal attack if we gave them Palestinian statehood. But she put clear conditions on that.
She did. She was trying to preempt that criticism that she knew would come. We've heard it from Simon Birmingham, the Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister. We've heard it from Peter Dutton that this is putting statehood before security. That this rewards terrorists. It gives them something for the actions of October 7. Penny Wong was saying Israel's very security relies on a two-state solution, so you can't differentiate them quite that much. But it's a tricky line to walk, and it's had a fairly mixed reaction from the community as well.
And as we've said, a very strident reaction from the opposition. I mean, Peter Dutton gave a speech this week at the Opera House, no less, where he described Labor's position as reckless and accused Penny Wong of, quote, irreparably damaging relations with Israel. But we'll get into that with Karen a little later, Mel, because we need to touch on another major speech from the government this week, very much on domestic matters. The Prime Minister in Queensland unveiling our version of Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act without a price tag to match, I should say, without that $1 trillion investment in clean energy subsidies and programs we've seen in the US. Anthony Albanese has called this the Future Made in Australia Act.
It's quite the name.
It's quite the name.
It would be quite the price tag too if we were trying to match the Americans, but that's definitely not going to happen. Look, there's some really big ideas in here, but not necessarily a lot of detail. And look, there's pluses and minuses to that. Anthony Albanese's flagged that this is something he's going to be building on. And the fact that it is open means that he can sort of mould and shape this to the circumstances and opportunities that arise, looking at what competitive advantages Australia has when it comes to the global economy. The minus is, and I think this is a very big risk, is that it ends up being quite amorphous and wieldy, and no one's really quite sure what he's talking about when he is talking about this Future Made in Australia Act, because it encompasses so many different things and in a not necessarily clearly defined way at this stage.
Yeah, it encompasses so many things and yet nothing. And it's also not the first time he's flagged it. He gave a major speech in February when he said we needed to, quote, think big, and we don't have to go dollar for dollar with the US and Europe, but we can go toe to toe on the quality and impact of our policies. So I think we can definitely take from that it won't be a mega dollars package. The price tag will come in or closer to the budget, I understand. We won't know the dollars until then. But this week, Anthony Albanese said we need sharper elbows and we need to be willing to break with old orthodoxies, which is clearly code for being prepared to get back in the business of picking winners and subsidies for clean energy businesses. Last year, a coalition of climate groups and the ACTU suggested a $100 billion fund is what's needed to get Australia into the game. So I can't see the government spending that much. But
I'm not seeing that either at this point in the budget cycle.
But it has got a lot of money already in existing funds, like the $15 billion National Reconstruction Fund, the $20 billion Rewiring the Nation Fund, the $1 billion Hydrogen Fund. So if you roll all that into it, it's re-announcing, to be sure. But as you say, it's got to give some bones to this amorphous, grand-sounding Future Made in Australia Act.
Yeah, and it's only going to work if it works over a long time frame. And for it to work over a time frame, it needs to work beyond one political cycle, beyond one political term, and beyond the life of a Labor government to some inevitable point in the future when the winds of power change and the coalition are back in power too. So I don't see how you have a grand plan of this scale that works unless you have buy-in from the opposition as well, and that is going to be a challenge.
And that's why I think the Prime Minister is very much pitching it as a jobs package and a manufacturing package and Australia's sovereign capability package, because, you know, obviously people respond to that. If it's big money being spent, but it's going to generate jobs, it's going to, you know, keep us safe during the next pandemic or the next war that, you know, stops supplies coming through, you can see the buy-in coming politically. And that's very much going to be the pitch of this rather than as selling it as an energy transition policy, I think.
Certainly. But people will want to see results soon too. They won't give you too much credit for too long and before they want to see actual results from that. So that's going to be another challenge.
That's right. Promises are just promises. I think this is the perfect time to bring in our guest. What do you think?
Let's do it. Karen Middleton, political editor at The Guardian Australia. Welcome to the party room.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, Karen, it is fantastic to have you back and in your new role at The Guardian. Now we get you every day, not just once a week, which is a win-win for us.
Multiple times a day.
Yeah, I know. It's really no rest for the wicked in that gig. I want to start with Penny Wong's speech and her comment that Palestinian statehood ultimately is the ultimate path to Israel's security. She said it, quote, could help build momentum towards a two-state solution. She also said her government is working with the international community on a pathway beyond the immediate conflict. That's the quote. So we're not completely out of step with our allies, though perhaps the comments from Penny Wong were were blunter, do you think? Why did she do it in this way?
So I think a few reasons. I think we did hear some similar comments from British Foreign Secretary David Cameron. So in that sense, we're sort of in step with them, but it felt when she first made those comments that she was going out a bit harder. And I think she did sort of moderate that in terms of timing afterwards. But I think there's something else going on. There are two things going on. There are discussions in the international community about the point at which Palestinian statehood should be contemplated. And it has been, up until now, really talked about as a sort of an end state after this war is over, after everything is, after there's dialogue, then talk about statehood. What I think the international community is now looking at is thinking about that earlier in the process, that perhaps that could be part of political dialogue or negotiations earlier than they had originally said. So instead of happening at the end, happening somewhere in the middle,
The fact that she's come out with it so bluntly in this speech, does it suggest that there's talk going on behind the scenes between, you know, Britain, US, yeah, Australia, that you know, she not felt emboldened is not the right word, but this is part of a strategy, or is it a domestic politics at play here?
So there are two things. So the first part is that the talks going on behind the scenes are about moving it up in the list of priorities. So it's not the first thing. The first thing would have to be the relinquishment of the hostages and the stopping of firing in Gaza. But then somewhere after that, when negotiations were underway, I think the international community is now talking about pushing this up as part of negotiations rather than being at the end. Now, that's going to get some resistance from Israel and elsewhere, but that's what they're talking about. But as well as that, there's another process going on. The United Nations is about to debate this issue again. It'll go into the Security Council. There may be a veto applied about statehood there. That's possible. But either way, it'll probably end up in the General Assembly, probably being debated and probably going to a vote, even if it's not a legally binding vote because the Security Council has vetoed. So Australia is going to have to fix a position very soon. Well, it's sometime this month. We don't know exactly when. So it's interesting. Her comments are in proximity to this, and it does sound to me like she's starting to foreshadow inching towards statehood, endorsement of statehood in a more direct way. I don't think Australia has fixed its position for the UN yet, but it's going to have to show its hand.
Yeah, but
it's going to have to vote and make a call.
That's very difficult to do when Hamas is still in charge in Gaza, isn't it? And there's no governance structure for Gaza if and when Israel achieves its goal of defeating Hamas. And if it is to achieve its goal of defeating Hamas, it says that needs it have to invade Rafah, and the Australian government doesn't support the invasion of Rafah. So this is layer upon layer here of complexity.
Yes, and everything depends on everything else. So there's a lot of complexity going on. We don't know what the any wording of a motion would be at the UN. We don't know what the timing of the motion is. We don't know what the timing might be of the suggestion of progress to statehood or what conditions might be placed on it. So there's a lot that's not known, and I think that's probably why Australia hasn't fixed its position. But it seems that Penny Wong has taken the decision to be a little bit clearer about moving statehood up on the list of things that should happen and in line with other countries, and that all of these things going on in the background a part of that consideration.
And if there's a lot of complexity at an international level, I guess we can add further layers of complexity when we look at the domestic position here. We've had a lot of condemnation from high-profile Jewish organisations about this this nuanced change from Penny Wong, and Peter Dutton's gone even further. He went to quite an extraordinary extent as well, I think, suggesting that not only these comments are, you know, risk causing irreparable damage. He went further in that speech he gave recently where he was comparing the situation here on the ground where there have been Palestinian protests when the Israeli flag was lit up at the Opera House after October 7. He's compared that with the Port Arthur massacre, accusing the Albanese government of missing the moment, going soft. Here he is.
The Prime Minister and members of his government have downplayed the unprecedented level of anti-Semitism afflicting our country by dishonestly treating it as analogous with other forms of prejudice. Foreign Minister Penny Wong made that moral fog denser last night. Whilst no one was killed during the protests on October 9, thank God, the events at the Sydney Opera House were akin to a Port Arthur moment in terms of their social and national significance.
Karen, at a time when Penny Wong is working with a delicate nuance with international partners, we've got a very strident and unambiguous remark from Peter Dutton there.
Indeed. And Penny Wong, the foreign minister, has criticised political leaders for politicising this whole issue in a domestic context. She's leveled criticisms both at the Greens and at the Coalition, and particularly at Peter Dutton. This speech was the Tom Hughes Oration, which is an annual oration that is organised by Julian Lisa, the member for Barara. It's a Liberal Party oration, and it's in honour of Tom Hughes, who was the original member for that seat. And different people give it every year. Peter Dutton gave it at the Opera House, and he took the opportunity to refer back to the protests outside the Opera House just a couple of days after that Hamas terrorist attack on Israel of October last year. And that was the frame for what was essentially a domestic political speech. He had a big go, as he said, at Penny Wong for raising the statehood thing, for being reckless, he said. But he also had a huge go at the police. And remember, he's a former policeman from Queensland, and at Labor politicians, and particularly the Prime Minister, for what he said was fueling anti-Semitism. He said police should be arresting people more for protests that he alleges are anti-Semitic. And he says all of this has fueled anti-Semitism in Australia. Now, it was a highly charged and highly political speech. Certainly, you know, exactly the kinds of things I think that Penny Wong has been criticising and worrying about in terms of the finely balanced state of the community and the social cohesion in the community, because a lot of people feel very deeply already about this issue. So there'll be views, I'm sure, forcefully expressed over time about the wisdom or not of that speech, but he's made a very, very deliberate intervention linking domestic politics with the Australian position on Gaza. And that's unusual, because normally, as you say, we have a bipartisan position.
Yeah, and even when there's been controversial or nuanced changes in this area, it's certainly not just Penny Wong. I'm thinking back to the Morrison government's decisions to change recognition on Jerusalem as a position that came a bit out of the blue. Is it really a reasonable analysis of Peter Dutton to suggest that this is a really radical shift by Penny Wong when we've had some pretty big changes made by the Morrison government as well?
Well, it started to be a hallmark of this whole issue around Middle East peace, isn't it, in terms of Australian domestic politics, that we've seen political leaders take steps that were unexpected, and that doesn't always happen on foreign policy matters. You're right, we saw it with Jerusalem and the Morrison government. We've seen the rhetoric from the Albanese government gradually getting stronger, and I think this terrible incident involving the deaths of the aid workers, including Australian Zombie Frankham, has almost emboldened the government or allowed it to speak more forcefully and more publicly and raise concerns that I think have been raised more carefully or in private with Israel. A lot of countries, including our own, that were affected by that attack and are speaking more forcefully. So you're seeing this gradual increase in rhetoric, and I think this statehood comment was a further leap forward. The question is whether it's a leap too far, and there's a lot of views around about the good and the bad of doing that, and certainly the opposition has pushed back extremely forcefully and as you said, foreshadowed that this could really damage relations with Israel. And we've also appointed Mark Binskin, the former Air Force chief as an advisor, in inverted commas, to try and sort of extract more information from Israel out of the investigation into those aid workers. He's a former chief of the Defence Force. He's got rank, so that's important. And he's an Air Force guy, so he understands the nature of targeting, and that's quite deliberate. They don't want to be seen to be running a separate international investigation. They're trying to extract information. So there are a number of pressure points now on Australia's relationship with Israel, and statehood comments are another one.
It's a very interesting time, isn't it, in politics here in Australia, because generally foreign policy is not so much foregrounded in our domestic political debate. And, you know, Penny Wong herself spent the first year and a half of this government moving around the region, the Pacific in particular, doing a very good job, you know, attracting admiration really from all sides. And now she's really in the political hot seat right now, isn't she, through foreign policy. And it's very unusual for us to have what or to be moving away from bipartisan support on foreign policy.
Yes, indeed, although I remember, I think, because the Pacific engagement was very much linked to relations with China, I think the Labor in opposition was critical of the Morrison government for what it said was falling down on engagement with the Pacific, and it sort of reinforced that when it got into office. So we've seen these sort of breakouts, and we, of course, we saw a difference over China and how the Morrison government approached it, and the Albanese government has made a point of noting that it's chosen a different path. Now, part of that was just the change of government and China deciding they would talk to us again.
Yeah.
But there have been a range of foreign policy issues that have started to become significant in domestic politics and seen some differences between the major parties. But this one on the Middle East is certainly one of the most dramatic.
Karen, you mentioning Mark Binskin before reminds me of some of the other big changes we've had this week. Is a big shake-up at the top of the Defence Force. We have our next Chief of the Defence Force has been announced. Vice Admiral David Johnston will be at the top of the defence tree when they do the handover. It's an interesting appointment. It's certainly an interesting time to have someone from the Navy at the top of the Chief Defence Force when nuclear submarines are obviously a very big priority in defence circles at the moment. But what do you make of his selection at this point in time?
You're right. I think the Navy thing is significant, and also the fact that he's been the vice chief for some years. So it's a continuity choice in a lot of ways. It's not a surprise, particularly. He is from the Navy, and all the focus in the Defence Strategic Review, or a large amount of it, has been on our maritime capabilities, our capabilities offshore, less of the Defend Australia onshore, but Defend Australia further afield, which naturally strongly involves the Navy. So that's a logical choice in that regard. It's interesting, though, that he's only been appointed for 2 years, not the usual three or longer. And so it does look like almost an interim choice. And whether that's by agreement, by negotiation, whether it was his suggestion isn't clear, but it's shorter than usual. So we will presumably see another change, and maybe there are those others coming through that are being sort of lined up for later. But in the interim, he's a continuity choice and not one that's shaking things up.
Yeah, it looks like a placeholder in a sense, and certainly not a change, and certainly not...
Without wanting to diminish him
at all. I mean, he's a man of great experience and held in great regard, I understand that, but there have been calls, particularly I'm thinking from the veterans who gave evidence to the Royal Commission into veteran suicide, the comments from the commissioner of that Royal Commission, Nick Caldos, who reflected calls for a new culture, a new leadership in defence. You know, people were perhaps looking for a new look in defence and a new direction in not just the culture but also strategic thinking. I imagine we won't and can't get that from David Johnston because he's been the vice deputy for such a long time, even as you say, not to diminish his experience.
Yeah, I certainly don't think this is signalling a dramatic change in direction or a change in the way defence has been projected, or even a change in the relationship between the minister and defence. You know, there are always... Yeah. There's always
the minister's been very, very critical of the defence leadership.
Well, this is one of the curious things, I think, as well, Fran, is that we've had Richard Marles point to the need for change in both the Department of Defence and the CDF in the ranks, yet we've had an extension of Angus Campbell, and now we've got the vice coming up. But having said he wants change, this doesn't really seem to be the change candidate he's brought forward.
No, it's not signifying any dramatic shift at all, I don't think. And there are, as you say, concerns among some serving and former members that there hasn't been an adequate acknowledgement of the impact on veterans' mental health and the like. There's also been criticism of the defence leadership around the allegations of war crimes and why the top of the tree are not being scrutinised or criticised or questioned about their role up the chain of command in overseeing events in the Middle East and that resulted in these alleged incidents that are now being investigated. So on a number of fronts, some concern and criticism about defence leadership, but this is certainly not signalling a dramatic break or change in direction, that's for sure.
Look, Karen, the AUKUS alliance, which is going to be the key work for David Johnston from this point forward and for the next few that follow him as well, look, they've confirmed this week that they are considering collaborating with Japan on Pillar 2 of the AUKUS strategy. So just to be clear, Pillar 1 is very much around Australia's acquisition of nuclear submarines, but Pillar 2 is more about technological advancements, cybersecurity, missiles, artificial intelligence, quantum computing and how that can work into our security situation. The engagement of Japan, though, comes just as the country is sort of increasingly concerned about China in the region. So what does Japan's possible involvement signal in geostrategic terms?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? My understanding is it's been talked about for at least a couple of years, and I know that Japan had indicated it was interested, even keen, on being part of this alliance in the second pillar that you just described.
Because it's not JAUKUS, is it? This is just pillar two.
Well, it's been described as JAUKUS, but then you start hearing suggestions that Canada might get involved too, so we could be JAUKUS. I don't know.
It
explodes your head when you get into that domain. But I think, you know, you could read it a number of ways. This is thus far a very Anglo alliance, three members of the so-called Five Eyes group of countries that share intelligence are the members of AUKUS, which stands for Australia, UK, US. So bringing in someone from North Asia, a country from North Asia, does signify that it is a slightly different grouping, and there were some questions being asked around the rest of Asia about the meaning of the AUKUS alliance because it sort of came out of the blue. So it could be a reassurance in some respects to some countries in Asia. It might not be that for China because there have been historical tensions between Japan and China. So you're right, that could further increase China's anxiety about AUKUS if indeed it could get any more anxious about it. But there are questions about whether Japan can manage the secrecy and protecting the technology secrets and the technology transfer that's involved, or whether its systems are not up to the same standards as those other countries. So I think there's a way to go yet, but clearly the fact that the leaders of the three AUKUS countries in a statement finally, formally and out loud said they were contemplating Japan suggests we're a fair way down the road to getting them involved at that second pillar.
And Karen, just finally, a potential breakthrough for Julian Assange. The US President Joe Biden was asked about Australia's request to drop efforts to prosecute the WikiLeaks founder who's wanted on espionage charges. This was his answer. We are considering it. Karen, three short words, but with potentially very big consequences. It seems to be a shift. Anthony Albanese has said publicly he wants this. Enough is enough. He said that in a number of times. Does this suggest the Prime Minister has prosecuted this very robustly with Joe Biden and that it is very much on the table? What do you think?
Well, it does sound like we're inching towards a more contemplation of what Australia is requesting. You know, we've seen with the Albanese government, obviously a lot of diplomacy behind the scenes and then the gradual expression of public concern. Now, sometimes you don't express public concern in this kind of diplomatic relationship until you've already made gains in private. Sometimes you express public concern in order to push it further, and maybe it's a bit of both things. But it is interesting that we're now hearing from the president a suggestion, even if it's off the cuff, that he might be contemplating that. We've sort of got to crunch time in the court in the UK with Julian Assange, and there was a slight unexpected delay recently. So it has to be decided very soon whether the United States is going to press ahead with the extradition, whether some other arrangement is in train, but it does sound like there are things moving much more than we've heard and seen in the past.
I think there is too a delicate issue here of, is it really about dropping a prosecution or is it about trying to find a plea deal, which might be more acceptable on the American side because it doesn't have that look of interfering in the judicial system. But with the US presidential elections coming pretty close, the window of opportunity in which to seal this deal is definitely becoming much, much smaller.
Yeah, I think that's right. Karen, it's great to have you with us this week. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you, Karen.
We'll move to questions without notice. We'll give the call to the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
Order.
Well, the bells are ringing, which means it's time for question time here on the Party Room. And this week's question comes from Susanna.
Growing outrage over Washington's support for Israel is prompting many Arab American and Muslim voters to declare that they intend to stay away from the polls in November, hurting Biden's chances of re-election. My first question is, could the Arab Muslim community's outrage over Canberra support for Israel and Australia hurt Anthony Albanese's chances in the upcoming election? And secondly, is there a political benefit for Albanese to support Israel?
Thank you, Susanna. Mel?
Great question from Susanna. It's certainly one that's exercising a lot of political minds in the US right now and here in Australia too. There's definitely some similarities we can look at, but I think there's also some really important differences between what we have here in Australia and what we see in the US. And I think a big part of that is turnout. You know, turnout is a major issue in US presidential elections. Will people actually come out to vote for Joe Biden if they're unhappy with how he's handling the situation in the Middle East? Whereas in our system of compulsory voting sort of takes that away. You know, Arab and Muslim communities or anyone frustrated with Labor's stance will still have to make a choice in the ballot box. So if they don't want to vote for Labor, who do they choose? So they could choose the Greens or another minor party or independent that has a position on the Middle East that is more to their liking. But whether that leads to another seat in the House of Representatives going to an independent or a Green or someone else, another minor party, is pretty questionable, I think, because there's only a few seats that the Greens realistically have a shot of picking up. You know, maybe Wills in Victoria is perhaps an example of that. That doesn't necessarily overlap with where the biggest concentrations of Arab or Muslim voters are. In a lot of those seats, it's more of a direct Labor-Liberal contest. So maybe we could see a bit more of that impact in the Senate, but I just don't think it's going to have the same kind of hard political impact here in Australia as it might do in the US presidential election. What do you think, Fran?
Well, I think... yes and no. I think it's sometimes hard to predict. I mean, you say, yes, I agree with you, Wills is one where clearly the Greens have a shot. But, you know, I'm sure Labor would have been hopeful of winning back Griffith, which is held by Max Chandler-Mather for the Greens. Mm. That was a bit of a surprise. You know, that was Kevin Rudd's seat for such a long time. It has been in Labor hands for a long time. It's lost that seat to the Greens. Is this going to make it harder? But it's also not just the seats the Greens might pick up. Melbourne's seat of McNamara, which Josh Burns holds, was under threat last time from the Greens. Now, it might not be the sort of Palestinian support vote that plays out there, but the Israeli vote. It's a very heavy Jewish electorate in terms of numbers, and Josh Burns picked up some of that support, but he may lose some of that support too next time around. So different seats may come into play in the western seats of Sydney, for instance, where there's big Muslim populations. Is it possible that Labor could lose votes to an independent that comes through? So there's things that could play out. I think Labor seems to be worried about it. I mean, some suggest that some of the utterances by Penny Wong and others, you know, were very much in the mode of trying to signal support to both sides. But it's definitely, I think, a very highly tuned political element at the moment. And that's what that speech we heard from Peter Dutton was all about too. Great question, Susanna. Send your questions in. We love getting them. We particularly like the voice notes that we got from Susanna there. You can email us on thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And remember to follow The Party Room on the ABC Listen app. That's how I like to listen to it when I'm on the listening end and not on this side of the microphone. So you can make sure you don't miss any episodes if you tune in on the app.
And we love having you this side of the mic. So thanks very much for filling in. PK will be back next week. And Mel, I'm sure you'll be back at the very least as a guest on The Party Room. I hope so. So we'll see you all next week. See you, Mel.
See you, Fran. Thanks.